Hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle and this week we're going to be talking about what listener Sam Dean has called the greatest Premier League season of all time. And more, and of course the Champions League. And joining me to do exactly that is chief writer at Squawker, Mohamed Butt. Mohamed, welcome to the podcast.
I'm glad to be here. I don't know if it's the best of all time, but it's a damn good title race, isn't it?
It's damn good. And also talking about this damn good title race is chief editor at Squawker, Will Hall. How are you?
Very well, very well. Thank you for actually asking me how I am this week.
Yeah, because I never do it usually. But as you said before, I didn't ask you this morning, so I saved it especially for the podcast to give you that authentic feel that you so crave.
I know, I'm torn.
And also,
I'm torn between the courtesy I demand and
you need to make your mind up.
The authenticity I crave.
And someone that someone's mind that is always absolutely made up is another Squawker editor. Sam Long, you're on the podcast as well. How are you feeling about that?
All good, thank you.
Yeah, enjoying it. We'll dive straight into the biggest game of the weekend, which was clearly the one at Anfield. Fortress Anfield, 38 games unbeaten now in the Premier League at home, Liverpool are. But they came up against a Chelsea side that had chances to disrupt that and potentially end it. Eden Hazard missing two. But we all watched the game. I'm pretty sure everyone watched the game this week, so I don't need to give you all a complete recap of what happened. We're going to dive straight into the key points of it and the, chronologically, if you will, the first thing that came up was Mauricio Sarri starting Hudson-Odoi Loftus-Cheek, which was great. But that meant that Eden Hazard went into false nine, and he's been banging that drum all season, Mo, and it sounds like...
It's like fetch. It's just stop trying to make it happen. It's never going to happen. I understand the logic behind Hazard as a false nine. It makes a lot of sense, right? So you can see why the coaches keep going back to it. He doesn't like to defend. He does it, but he doesn't like to do it. And frankly, you don't want your best player chasing back into your own half anyway if you can help it. So you don't want to have him chasing Trent Alexander-Arnold, you know? Mm. But then if he doesn't chase him, then Alexander-Arnold's going to go and you're going to be exposed. And at the same time, Hazard also likes to roam. So if you play him left wing, you're like, Eden, play left wing. And he goes, yeah, all right, for 5 minutes. Then he's on the right wing. And, you know. And again, you don't want to stop him doing that. He's brilliant. So combining those two, what's the solution to those two issues? Well, Hazard won't listen to me. He won't hold a position. I don't want to exhaust him chasing back. Play him in the middle. And because Sarri won't change to a 4-2-3-1, it has to be a false nine. But he can't play. I mean, he did it in the Carabao Cup final. Because Chelsea played basically...
Oh, yeah.
Park the bus, let City put everyone but two men forward, and then just, yeah, he played a 2v1 game. He can do that.
Yeah.
But, like, you're not going to play that game. You can't do that against literally anyone else because no one else dominates the ball as well as Man City to enable you to do that.
And that's the point. Is Chelsea actually... Liverpool were perhaps in control and had more of it. Fabinho is now at the base of midfield again, putting in a lot of tackles on Hazard early on. And they were talking about that in the sense that when you put Hazard in the middle, I think Van Dijk said, I just want to play against the best players in the world. And although when you are meant to be false nine, you're not playing up against them. But Sam, what were your thoughts on Hazard being used there? Because it so happened that in the second half, when he moved and Higuain came on, immediately Hazard had two chances that were in central areas, but it was born out of the fact that, as Mo said there, he's roamed into that rather than just sitting there straight away.
Yeah, well, once he moved that wide, it was almost like he sort of had the bit between his teeth and he looked like he wanted to prove something to Sarri. And to be fair to Higuain, actually, I thought he looked all right when he came on, a bit sharper perhaps than he has done in recent weeks. I just think if you don't play Hazard out wide, then you take away so much of his strengths. In those one-on-one situations, I mean, he was devastating in the few minutes that he played there yesterday, and just taking so much away from him. And I think if you look at the bigger picture, that Chelsea are trying to persuade Hazard to stay and commit his long-term future to the club, and playing him as a false nine is not where it's at for Hazard.
Well, that's the thing. A main feature of sort of the social coverage on Squawker in the build-up to that was that Chelsea have these incredible ball carriers in their team, which is almost the antithesis of what Sarri actually wants, given the vertical passing, etc. But Hazard's ball carrying is based on him picking it up from deep in that sort of left pocket and running with it. And in false nine, you're almost 90% time with back to goal. So you have to come deep, then spin, and then dribble, which is just adding so much extra to the work he needs to do rather than just playing him on the left. Because there are occasions where Willian broke in the first half where you'd almost would have had Hazard in that position if he were playing out wide. And I just think my opinion on this is that despite Olivier Giroud not being the most prolific, the most athletic, the fastest striker in that Chelsea have, and Higuain is arguably more complete, he also has the relationship with Sarri, Olivier Giroud is an enabler, and all Hazard needs is someone to pass it to when he can't control it. Eden Hazard can quite easily run through an entire team, but there are occasions where he loses control, and all you need there is just a wall pass to rebalance yourself. Yeah. And Messi does it.
Yeah.
Messi's had the occasion where he used weird people to do it. He used Dani Alves to do it
for a while.
But Eden Hazard is their best player. So put someone on the pitch that amplifies the qualities of your best player, in my opinion.
That's 100% correct. And you look at the way, actually, Messi's a great example, because you look at the way he played false nine, and it was, this is part of the thing, is that they put Hazard false nine, but it's always in the kind of false nine that Totti was, that Fabregas was, that Firmino was to a degree. It's like there's a bit more of the nine about them. Mm. Whereas when you watch how Messi played false nine, that should have been the blueprint for Hazard, where he would literally come into central midfield, stand next to the midfielders, get the ball, and then move forward. But the thing is, to do that kind of false nine, you need to have one of your wingers needs to be a striker, first of all, like an actual striker, like to run infield and make infield runs. And then the other winger needs to be, I mean, Pedro, but like 5 years ago, you know, just phenomenally hard. But you can't do it with Hudson-Odoi is a winger, right? Like he's you couldn't really do it with, maybe you could do it with one of Hudson-Odoi, but then not Hudson-Odoi and Willian, because they're both too similar. They both want to be wingers, and that's great. But to play a false nine correctly, you can see on paper, it suits Hazard coming literally into midfield, getting the ball very deep, and then just dribbling, right? And that's perfect for Hazard, passing and dribbling. But you need one of those wingers to be an actual striker, because someone that's going to make actual infield runs and be able to drift infield and to cause defenders problems, you know. And
well, that's why it works so well for Liverpool, because they have two wide forwards that are now both on 17 plus goals.
Yep.
They both got on the score sheet in that game at Anfield. Completely different goals, obviously. One was a well worked move, Sadio Mane getting a header on it. The other one was a spectacular Mo Salah strike, which was arguably better than his Puskas award winner, despite him saying that was still his favourite goal because it was a derby. But I think, despite again the front three getting on the score sheet and making headlines, Firmino was okay. And again, he's an enabler to an extent as well with his work rate. But the one talking point about Liverpool all this season really has been that midfield composition. And in recent weeks, Jordan Henderson has moved from that number six at the base, one step forward into where he plays for England sometimes, into a more box-to-box role. And it looks like this was the midfield that Jurgen Klopp was planning all along, perhaps, Will. What are your thoughts on how Henderson's role has changed, and is this the midfield going forward for at least the end of this season?
I don't think it's planned, but I think it's a good example of Klopp sort of reacting to circumstance, because we know for a fact that Jordan Henderson sort of like banged on his door and said, I would like to be playing in this more advanced role. And I think that immediately preceded the sort of the little angsty touchline exchange that took place at Old Trafford.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a behind the scenes tactical alteration that's been played out in public in many ways. And so coming back to this idea that this isn't a planned thing, and you could say that while at one point it might have looked like Fabinho's arrival at the club was the beginning of the end for Henderson, especially when you consider that not only did he come in, but Keita came in at the same summer. And so those are kind of like the two roles that Henderson can play, which left only one spot in midfield. But instead of that, what Fabinho's long drawn out adaptation, or his sort of settling in period that was kind of imposed on him by Klopp, has done actually is it's opened up new possibilities, and it's given Henderson a new lease of life. And Mohamed said this on many occasions, and he's reminded us that he said it on many occasions even more frequently. But Henderson has been played out of position for, I think Klopp said, like 18 months he's been played out of position. And it's kind of like it's one of his strongest attributes, and a curse for him, is that he's a player who's just so willing to learn, so willing to sort of sort of try his hand at new things and really put in the effort, because he's a hardworking player on the pitch. But what his, how his career has panned out speaks to is how hardworking he is and his actual sort of like aptitude and his willingness to sort of apply himself to studying football behind the scenes. So he learned this new role and has been successful in it, got Liverpool, helped Liverpool to a Champions League final in this role that was not his natural one.
Yeah.
And now he's playing a pretty decisive role in two big games of late. Yeah. Three big games of late, actually, if you include the Porto game, where he's going to have a say in his going back to what he did originally at Sunderland, kind of, and he looks set to have a really big hand in the title race.
Well, that was the thing for me as well, as Klopp afterwards said we were trying to get Henderson in a number 10 position, which again I don't think he even was at Sunderland.
Well, he was a winger at Sunderland, but he kind of moved into the centre. So I mean, the number 10 position I find to be quite a vague.
Yeah, it just means get forward.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this is the thing, isn't it? We tend to think of it, a lot of footballers, we tend to think of 10 is very, very much Argentina, Serie A, the 90s kind of vibe of number 10. So the 10 is this slow-moving, ball-heavy playmaker. But yeah, 10 doesn't have to be like that. It just means, like, in Dutch parlance, 10 is the most advanced of your midfield three.
But I would say that Liverpool don't really have a number 10 because they've relied on... And I've gone over this in a previous pod where I was talking about the importance of fullbacks. But just one point on that subject. Another attacking possibility... There's two other attacking possibilities that it's kind of opened up, and I just want to go over them quickly. One is, like, the Keita coming in as well, who... is like a much more aggressive dribbler than the likes of Wijnaldum, who he was good at carrying the ball, but Keita just runs at people.
He was throwing some stepovers out as well.
Exactly,
which
he did one that was picked up by loads of Liverpool fans because it came at quite an anxious stage of the game where he did a sort of jig after just sort of like making this gesture of calm down at everyone, and it kind of reminded me of Van Dijk actually in how he's sort of come in and lent this sense of composure to what is actually, I mean, the whole heavy metal football thing is a bit of a cliche, but I mean, it is kind of a chaotic system that Klopp plays where everything depends on one-on-one situations that can go either way, and they add composure.
And Henderson very much speaks to the heavy metal side in the sense that he's 100%. This unlimited energy, box to box, I'm going to get back, I'm going to get forward, I'm going to get back again.
Yeah.
Whereas, as you said, Keita comes in now and just looks very suave on the ball. And that's something that Liverpool didn't have.
Yeah.
Coutinho had it to an extent, but again, he was very and miss. No, that was sort of...
And another element of control another attacking possibility that has been opened up by this Fabinho sort of adapting to the thing, which he plays himself in quite a chaotic way. I mean, most of his contributions are... to do with these like lunging tackles where he uses his long legs to sort of win the ball and play the defensive midfield role in a way that sort of goes against the conventional wisdom of, we've said this before, like if you have to make a tackle, you've done something wrong. But anyway, but the point I wanted to make there is that with having Henderson on the right side of the midfield but further up, it meant that Trent Alexander-Arnold sort of has to play a bit more defensively. And he was very, very strong in his defensive performance. But he's just so good at passing, and Liverpool have like two of the best long-range passers in the league in their back line. One of which, Van Dijk, who actually, I mean, what gets missed in that Salah goal is the pinged ball over the top that Van Dijk plays to him. But then you've got Trent Alexander-Arnold in a deeper role, but just operating as almost like a quarterback, but from wide right with these long, deep crosses, like early crosses as well, that sort of catch
those
defences.
Positionally, he's where Guardiola would underlap his fullbacks in his first season at City. Alexander-Arnold kind of plays in that pocket, but of course, because he has such an expansive passing range, like you say, it completely opens up. I mean, because Van Dijk plays on the left, right, and then you got Alexander-Arnold on the right. Liverpool have these two guys who can just like launch diagonal balls like ICBMs across the entire pitch. It becomes much harder to defend Liverpool narrow, like, you know, as you would like to, because they're just constantly switching the play and they've got this ability to do so. Henderson playing as the furthest forward midfield, I think, is perfect use of his skill set, because he's not as good in tight areas as Naby Keita. Keita can dribble out of anywhere. I mean, and Fabinho is a brilliant... I mean, again, I have been saying this already. Fabinho is a brilliant defensive player. And it's a huge... It's not just that he's got this awareness. It's a huge quality upgrade. Liverpool haven't had a defensive midfielder that solid for 10 years. It's Mascherano was there. Fabinho's phenomenal, and Keita is just a player oozing quality from every single pore of his body. Like, the way he plays is just magnificent to watch. Mm. And he, with those two there, not as a two really, but you know, you sort of have a little leeway to pick your third player how you want to play the game. So if you want to really keep possession and not get anything away, you could bring Wijnaldum in and play with those three. Yeah. You could then have a very solid possession-based midfield. And then, okay, you want to be a bit more dynamic, your default option, you would play Jordan Henderson because he can do a bit of everything. And his timing when he runs forward into the box, you know, it is dangerous. I mean, yeah, his run forward and that lovely cross for the opening goal was fantastic. And his instincts about where to go, where to grab the ball, you know, how to lift it. He has all this ability, and I'm sure other people remember, Liverpool fans might do. He once almost scored a really amazing chip against Man United where I think De Gea had to just palm it away. And it was just sort of like, people like to mock Henderson because he just seemed to be a better runner in his early days at Liverpool. But it was obvious even then he had exceptional quality. It was just he never sort of found a role to unleash it. And of course, we thought he found it at the base midfield, but now he seems to Klopp as like, oh, okay, yeah, he's really good. And so now it's like he's playing him in this role where it's just like, okay, use your energy and use your quality and really influence games.
So the one dangerous thing for Henderson now, in my opinion, is that we've said that he's had to change role because people have been brought in to compete with him, and he's almost won each of those battles, or they've moved forward and claimed another spot in the midfield. There is a dynamic midfielder that is just coming back from injury, and we don't know how dynamic he will be after that injury. But the role that Henderson's playing now is very much suited to Oxlade-Chamberlain, what Oxlade-Chamberlain himself has been crying out for in his entire football career. So I don't want to go too much into that because he's still far away, and it'll probably be a storyline for next season. But Oxlade-Chamberlain Henderson has won his battle in midfield, but he's got a new contestant, I think, about to be lined up. And again, if he wins that, then it's just a testament to Jordan Henderson's ability to...
It's good for Liverpool, though, man.
Yeah, it's brilliant for Liverpool.
They've got options. They've got a lot of depth.
I thought you were talking about James Milner there.
Well, no, James Milner is almost this in the same way, but he sort of does that fullback filling in. So he's got an emergency position if he wants. Jordan Henderson's going to be playing Firmino's role with false nine soon, because he's just going to keep moving further up the pitch because they upgrade it. But just quickly on Chelsea, they've almost done an Arsenal this season away from home against the big six. I think the aggregate score this season is 13-1 away from home. And then if you include last six away games, it's 16 goals they've conceded. Just quickly on that, is there anything that Sarri's done particularly that's been a cause for it? Or?
No, it's just not easy to play away to the big six. And especially if you're a new manager in a new league and your team, you have an uncooperative or semi-cooperative squad. And also the thing is, with Sarri's mode, it's a very high-risk kind of football. And getting that kind of football in your hardest away games, it's not easy. Mm. You know, so and there's always a tendency. This is a Chelsea squad that have for over a decade been raised on strictly counter-attacking football, strictly pragmatism. So to get them to, in big games, in pressure situations, to sort of like, no, let's actually play football, that's not easy to get through. So, you know, it's just a matter of time, really, I think.
I think seeing Chelsea's record away from home this season, it's sort of really hit home to me how much they've changed as a club, because they always used to be big, physical, away from home, like really sort of tough to beat, and they've just completely moved away from that now.
Well, it's almost like fans wanted to move away from that style, and now it's not getting results. It's almost like you can't have both of them. And mm-hmm. it's the identity crisis of how far do we go towards this Sarri style, or do we just stay to the roots that Mourinho implanted, in the sense that we'll win loads of trophies. It might not be that nice, but we're going to win the trophies at the end of it. That's something that they're going to have to deal with in the summer. Sarri could still get a trophy because they've obviously just came over against Slavia Prague, but they're taking a 1-0 away goal back to Stamford Bridge. Probably going to go through there. And really, as well, Liverpool-Porto is almost written off. I don't know if you want to give some analysis on whether Porto have a chance of overturning that, but based on the first leg and what happened last year in the Stadio Dragao, it's not looking good for Porto in that tie.
No, but I mean, for all of those reasons, it's ripe for an upset. they've got Pepe coming in, Hector Herrera coming in, Alex Telles is going to be fitter, and with that, and accompanied by the sense of injustice of a couple of dodgy refereeing decisions in the first leg, and the fact that they weren't really like vastly outplayed. I think I saw like Mark Lawrence and compared them to a lower league Premier League team, but I mean that wasn't the impression I came away from.
That was that spell.
It was like it was like the headline of a piece, and maybe it was some played up or whatever. But
you've been sucked in. You've done a De Bruyne for it.
Yeah, I've done a De Bruyne exactly. So and the atmosphere around this one, that it's a kind of a done thing, is worrying in itself.
It's dangerous.
It's risky, isn't it, for the players if you're going into that game?
I mean, I think Liverpool will win. I'm just laying the groundwork for if there is an upset, then I can say. I did try to say.
It's a bit different, isn't it? Because last year, the first leg was there. They went, blitzed it. And then the second one at Anfield was 5-0 with five away goals. Is a bit like that. Whereas Porto famously have a really good home record.
Yeah, really good at home. And I mean, Mourinho, you figure he's got a... he missed two really good chances. Yeah, they were unlucky with that handball. So...
And the Salah stamp potentially should have gone off.
I mean, yeah, that was...
I think if nothing else, you could say that this is just going to be a heavily motivated Porto team.
Yeah, I think they'll definitely give it all guns, but I just think... I mean, we'll do predictions later, but I just think...
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll get the actual predictions for that later on when we sort of do a wrap-up. Moving on quickly to one of the other Premier League games this weekend was... We won't dwell too much on it because it was a second-string Spurs
against
a relegated Huddersfield. But the main point is that Spurs have won all their games without Harry Kane this season. Yes, it's only five, but they keep winning without him. Some of the games have been a bit more important, and they've lost games with him against sides of equal or sort of not as much quality. Burnley comes to mind in that sense. But obviously they come into this with two strikers that play a similar role in Son and Lucas Moura, in the sense that they're electrically fast. They're the complete opposite to how Kane would play that role. But they're sort of, again, Llorente isn't great, isn't fantastic, and he's old. But he's that...
He's very handsome.
That was a brutal assessment. Isn't great, he's not fantastic, and he's old.
But this is what I mean. But, so it was sort of a backhanded compliment, but he's playing because they need a focal point. And what's so good about Harry Kane usually is that he's not old. He's a bit fast. He can't take people on. He can shoot. He can do it all. Whereas Llorente is there now to fill one sort of quarter of Kane's game. But he's now enabling some looser touches, allows people like Moura to run on. So just basically on that, he actually has the best minutes per goal involvement rate of any Spurs player in all competitions this season, which was a surprising stat, with 853 minutes of action. So does he need to get the nod against Man City?
I mean, I think it depends. If you want to go with both him and Son, then okay, you can play them both. But I think if it comes down to him versus Son, I think you've got to go with Son. I think if your plan is to play Llorente as the you know, the very handsome masthead of your team, then you need to then Son has to go ahead, because Son's just brilliant. Son is absolutely, I mean, he's better than Lucas, isn't he? I mean, I like Lucas. Oh, he's a bit of a fashion supporter, but you know, other than supporting fascists in Brazil, he's a quite a nice player to watch. But Son is different class, isn't he? Son is fantastic.
Well, it was Moura that got the first... Son scored the first goal at the stadium, but Lucas has one-upped him and scored the first hat-trick.
Harry Kane's been left in the dust.
Yeah, Harry Kane doesn't get to claim any of those titles, which, again, I don't know how much he gives towards them, but there's a reputation that he would have been crying that he didn't score the first goal.
I think Son should lead the line. We spoke last week about Spurs sort of having two options to press or not press and having to go for one and stick to it. Whereas this time, I think they're going to have to use a bit of both. And with Son up top, I think, well, he gives you a clear out ball because he's so quick. But then he can also drop off and press as well. Yeah. So I can't see Pochettino going for anything other than Son up top and then more. But I fancy him to start more, though, more on the left.
Yeah, so I think both just pure pace abuse from Spurs, almost like a FIFA game. But obviously they're playing against Man City, who we'll just touch on their win before looking closer at the Champions League game. Their 3-1 win against Crystal Palace was sort of, headlines were stolen by Sterling and De Bruyne, really. And more so De Bruyne, because he registered his first assist of the season.
He was.
With an incredible pass. And obviously the main talking point was that De Bruyne and Sane, who, again, maybe met his match in Wan-Bissaka, but at the same time as Wan-Bissaka met his match in Sane.
That was a fantastic duel to watch. They went at each other constantly. No one really had the advantage. It was really good.
So is De Bruyne sort of Has he sort of reminded Pep Guardiola that he needs to be starting in this second leg now against Spurs?
And I think Pep said, didn't he? He makes passes that no one else can see. And it's true. Like the assist wasn't like even his first or second best pass of the game. There were a couple of ones where he's just... We've forgotten how good he is, right? Because he's spent the rest of the season injured. And it's like... And they've been so good without him. It's been like, yeah, De Bruyne was very good. De Bruyne was amazing. There's a couple of passes he played against Palace where he's just like... Has he done that?
Yeah.
Where's he seen that space? And he's a remarkable player. It's going to be genuinely game. He'll start, obviously. I think Pep was very purposefully holding him back for the second leg and the game against Spurs in the league as well.
Yeah.
He didn't want to throw it all away. Like I said before, they won 13 games. And it was almost like Pep was saying, okay, look, if we're going to draw or lose points or not play very well, let's do it in the first thing when we can afford to. And then keep build up steam again for the end.
But yeah, you said exactly that, and your Pens worked their magic last week by having the only quarterfinal home leg he's lost was actually last season against Liverpool. So it could be two and abouts, but he'd obviously lost a lot of his. The last quarterfinal away leg he'd won was 2011. So yeah, if you were on Mo's wavelength, you would have expected that result. I'm not predicted 3-1 to Man City like someone on this podcast did.
What?
Which was me. But moving forward then into this actual game at the Etihad, City are the first team to score 150 goals this season. Their home record is brilliant. Did Spurs do enough with that 1-0 win? And will they have enough with Moura and Son? Maybe Llorente is the enabler, as I said, to do any damage? Or is this a City almost where Spurs want them?
Yeah, I think City are going to come flying out of the traps. I think they're going to... Look, Aguero has 7 goals and 7 against Spurs at the Etihad, although his last one was in 2014-15, but when he scored 4 against them. So, and he was very poor in their way, like, so he's got a bit of making up to do. He'll come out playing. De Bruyne is going to start almost certainly. Sterling, you think, will start. I have a feeling he's not going to... It will start Sané, not Riyad Mahrez. And, you know, having Sterling, Sané and Aguero flying up front with De Bruyne behind them. David Silva, or maybe even Bernardo Silva, gets to go next to De Bruyne. Fernandinho got rested at the weekend. Laporte, if you watch the game...
Well, the Fernandinho one, he might not even be fit.
Well, that's you know what? If you watch Gundogan at the weekend, he played pretty well as well, to be fair. Mm. So if they have to rely on Gundogan, it's not the end of the world. Laporte, as I was about to say, Laporte was fantastic. Really, I mean, you know how good he is. Everyone goes crazy over Van Dijk, but Laporte is not far behind Van Dijk's level. And yeah,
I think Laporte's passing is probably his. Van Dijk's long passing is really good, but Laporte's, when he steps up and just short medium range
passing is exceptional, and he's not as experienced, not as good of an organizer as Van Dijk is. Van Dijk's much better in that regard, but as pure defenders taking on their defensibility, he's phenomenal. And I just think City are going to come out, they're going to hammer Spurs, and I think they've been saving it for this, you know what I mean? It's been like...
Spurs have been hammered. It was almost similar to their Dortmund game. Obviously, they had a greater lead in the first leg, but they defended valiantly in that second leg in Germany and kept a clean sheet, and they'll be up for that test. Sam, do you have one final thing to say on this game?
I think Spurs have often been accused of lacking game management in the past, obviously when they lost to Juventus and went out. I think it's going to be a huge temptation for them to maybe play the game like it is a Premier League match and sort of get caught up in... Well, we all know how Premier League games are just chaotic. If that happens, it's definitely going to favour City. So it's about Spurs showing their temperament.
Because even the refereeing is just... It's like a subtle difference, but it's like a sort of level of...
One of those.
I'm not making a comment as to whether it's better or whether the standard is higher, but we've seen through the interpretation of the handball rule, which was different in the Champions League when Man United knocked PSG out as opposed to the Premier League. That these little tweaks, I was just sort of basically supporting what Sam says there. You shouldn't approach... It's almost like, you can't really afford to just approach it as though it's a Premier League game.
That's why it's difficult when the English face the English, isn't it?
That's why it's so good, isn't it?
Yeah. And their record against... We spoke about Chelsea's record away to the top six opposition. Spurs for a few seasons now, or in fact, for Pochettino's time there, their record away against Premier League oppositions has famously been poor.
Also, don't let Aguero take penalties. That's my big tip for Guardiola.
Don't let him take penalties.
Don't let him take penalties.
Well, it's Hugo Lloris in goal. He saved all of the 1-3 penalties.
Aguero scores quite a few penalties.
But
that's the thing. Is Messi even a good penalty taker?
No,
just because
not
he scores
really.
A lot of them.
Is it not just really easy to score penalties?
Yeah.
And there's no such thing as a good
one. In fact, that is actually a brilliant segue. That was I've reacted in that way because I was trying to think how we'd get onto this game, but now we have. Someone that scored two penalties in a game was Paul Pogba to somehow get Man United 3 points against West Ham. No, he changed his run-up to do exactly that.
Yeah,
because if he misses another one, he's the first player to miss four in a season. So I think someone told him that stat. I think someone told him that stat. And
he's reading your DMs on Twitter, isn't he?
Yeah, he's hacked the Squawker stat pack and found out what he needs to do. Although he won't bring any of the assist stat in, so he's obviously not looking at my stat pack specifically. Anyway, Paul Pogba, again, I laughed so much when he was awarded man of the match just for scoring two penalties. I could not comprehend that anyway. Yeah,
the best midfielder on the pitch was not Paul Pogba.
Exactly. And that was going to be my first point from that, is let's focus on West Ham first and then dive into Man United a bit afterwards. West Ham were who this season have just been incapable of predicting how they're going to perform. Tom's been on talking about West Ham's form and the fact that he doesn't know what's happening next. But they played so well against West Ham, Man United. And Declan Rice, who's I think who you're alluding to there, someone that's been linked to Man United, was supreme again against the big side.
He's such a good footballer. It's absurd. Like 57 passes, 87% completion. He had 32 of those passes in the opposition half. 84% completion. He's complete 84% of his passes in the opposition half. That's impressive. He won the ball about 9 times without committing a foul. He's just a brilliant midfielder. He can do it all. You hear people say, he's a centre-half. No, he's not a centre-half. He's a midfielder. You can see he's a midfielder. I know he can defend and he's tall, but that doesn't mean he has to play centre-half. This is not the 90s, for God's sake. He's Declan Rice is a really, really promising midfield talent. Whether he goes to Man City or Man United or wherever he goes next, and he is, with all due respect to West Ham, he's better than West Ham. So wherever he goes next, and I'm sure he'll move on in the summer because I think he's too good to stay there, and there are too many clubs that need midfielders like that. He was phenomenal. He dominated Old Trafford, showed his skill. If he had better teammates, West Ham could have won the game. Or, you know, if they hadn't, hadn't gotten that weird penalty, which the first one was very strange.
But penalty, and also in terms of West Ham's teammates, did they actually do anything that was... There are a couple of Felipe Anderson shots where if he put a bit more shape on it, it maybe would have gone in. But West Ham were flying forward against Man United. And if it wasn't for Antonio, who, again, is sort of one of the... If he's playing up front, you'd maybe think, yes, we can improve that area. He came on the pitch, turned inside, smacked one against the bar. And then if he just got a bit more contact on a header and David De Gea, they could have scored again. So it wasn't even in that game in particular that West Ham's lack of quality. And again, before the podcast, I said to Tom, is there anything that West Ham fans were sort of taking away from that game? And all they're more annoyed about is the fact that they've got quite naive fullbacks that can't defend in Fredericks and Masuaku. Yeah. But then Masuaku was doing his Masuaku thing and dribbling forward. So West Ham, again, Declan Rice is sort of the jewel in their crown at the moment at all. And yeah, it's going to be difficult to hold on to him because Ruben Loftus-Cheek's probably the only midfielder that has made him look average or made him look his age because of his ability to just dribble past him in that Chelsea win. But if you watch Declan Rice in all of the games against the Big Six this season, he's been West Ham's best player. And that, moving forward, even if you've done that in your first full season in the position you want to play, that is pretty impressive. But I was genuinely taken aback by how unimpressive Man United were. And I don't know whether it was me just getting emotional about the fact that Arsenal in this race for the top four, West Ham deserved to win, they could have pegged them back. But Solskjaer said after the game, he said something about...
He said himself that it was like one of the worst performances ever, and he says if that was Barcelona, they would have scored five.
Yeah, so that's the Barcelona game coming up, and if they play like that again, I think they said they were going to struggle, is the quote there. But was it the worst of Solskjaer's reign so far? Did anyone have any opinions on that?
No, yeah, I would say it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. Because it's also one of those things, right? It's like United aren't playing necessarily brilliantly right now anyway. And then there's also, they've just put in massive effort to get with Barcelona, to handle Barcelona, to try and keep Barcelona back. And it's like, you know, they lost 1-0. And then they've got to go again in a few days to the Camp Nou to play Barcelona. So it's hard not to imagine that all the players that were playing there were like, thinking, had that in the back of their minds. You know, Pogba, certainly, you're thinking, okay, I don't want to strain myself because if I get hurt at all, it's over. We can't go to Barcelona and do anything, you know. You just can imagine, like, I think the only player that I thought I saw really going full out was Jesse Lingard, because he just doesn't know how to
do it. He was quite poor. Mm.
Well, yeah, he's trying to play his way into the team for Barcelona.
Yeah, yeah. So he was going all out. Everyone else was just sort of, you could see it was on their minds, right? So it's in a way it's understandable, but yeah, that was not good.
But that's what I mean. Jose Mourinho was hounded out because they were playing teams at Old Trafford and not looking like a Man United team that were dominating the ball and creating loads of chances.
Yeah, but context is important. Jose Mourinho did that in every game, not just in between games against Barcelona. So, you know, it was, I mean, God, I dread to think what Jose Mourinho would have done in between games against Barcelona.
I would just say that it's almost like, my opinion of this is that the Solskjaer appointment, the hiring as the caretaker was almost a masterstroke, because you're just getting in this guy that's going to make everyone happy, completely lift the mood. The reports that he's not parking in Sir Alex Ferguson's space because he's the real boss.
Coward.
It's just some of the most like ridiculous sort of narrative story that they're trying to run for this season, and that works for a caretaker. But now next season, and Solskjaer has said that it's going to be difficult. Liverpool, Man City have been too good. But now the big test is you've got Solskjaer in, this guy that is making everyone happy and rightfully so, and well done to the job he's done. But now you're going to entrust him with what's reportedly going to be about 200 million, making Jadon Sancho your top target.
Well, they should never have given the job before the season.
Well, that's my sort of point I was making, but they have done now. And is throwing money and giving all this money to Solskjaer going to actually change anything for this Man United side? Is that what they need, just investment?
No, as it stands, no, it's not going to solve their problems. And anyone paying attention to what's happened at Man United and how it's been run over the past few seasons has to conclude that it would actually make it worse. Their issue is, if it goes badly for Solskjaer now, and they end up having to sack him by like November next season, which I know I don't want to be too hasty to judge him, by the way, but but it's conceivable that it could happen because
Roberto Di Matteo all over again.
Exactly, because the mood and the situation at a club, a big six club, can just change so quickly. Yeah. With like three defeats, the whole situation, the whole vibe that he's created could be reversed. So if they do that, and if that transpires, then they will have fallen into a trap that they kind of let set for themselves, because we've said before, they hired him at a point where they had an easy run of games, so they could actually generate morale. And he came in, generated the morale, and then they bought into the morale boost, hired him. So if that happens, then that will be the story of what's happened there. And it will be yet another example of how the club is mismanaged. I think they do need to invest a whole lot of money because they've created the squad's been mismanaged essentially, and it's going to cost money to reverse that. But if they continue to just simply take that approach of like going for these sort of like high profile buys, like spending money, and we've got to consider that it's been quite a disjointed sort of tactical approach in terms of playing styles that have been installed there by managers who aren't really similar to each other. So essentially what I'm getting at is what needs to change is they need to hire a sporting director, because although Ed Woodward is a hugely talented sort of chief financial officer or executive vice chairman, I think is his name, he's bringing in all these sort of tractor sponsorships, noodle partners, this kind of thing. Sounds ridiculous, but I mean there's a reason Man United are as rich. Exactly. That is what you want. So they need to bring in the sporting director, but the problem they've done is that the sporting director should be someone who brings a sense of continuity that there's been lacking. And most clubs that are clever are doing this, because while managers can get sacked very quickly, because given the results-based nature and how there's not really as much loyalty or patience within sport.
And who else do you sack to change it?
But with a sporting director, they kind of go under the radar, so you don't necessarily have the same turnover. And coming back to this issue of how the squad's been mismanaged, like no Big Six team has a worse record in the market than Manchester United, I think it's fair to say. Major flops involve sort of Falcao, Schweinsteiger and Di Maria, but more recently Alexis Sanchez. Mm. But not only are they bad at buying players, they're terrible at selling them. They've allowed players to run down their contract. They've got Juan Mata leaving for free, Ander Herrera leaving free because they were unable to renew their contracts. They've also been able to sell the likes of Marco Rocco and Matteo Darmian, despite the players really kind of wanting to leave and not being quite good enough for the club. It's because of this unique issue they have, is that they're Man United, they have the biggest wage bill in the Premier League. So players are heavily incentivized against leaving the club.
Well, when they see people like Ashley Young and Phil Jones getting renewed contracts, then you'd think, well, they deserve it.
It's honestly absurd. The contract situation is so funny because you could see it coming 2 years ago. Like there was all these contracts were expiring at the end of 2017-18. And instead of sorting out then, they were just like, okay, well, they had club options for an extra year. And they just kicked it down there. Like, renew for another year. And then we'll leave it to them.
That's literally what you do on Football Manager.
Exactly. And then they didn't address it, though. That's the thing. They bought themselves extra time. And then they didn't actually go in there and say, okay, Ander Herrera, let's negotiate you a new deal this summer. Let's Ashley Young, go away. You know, Juan Mata, we love you. You're the greatest human being possibly in football. But, you know, we have no space for you in the squad. You know. Go somewhere else. They just let it all happen. And David De Gea,
he's one of them. Major one.
I think it's just the lack of concrete contenders for this sporting director role, though, is worrying. I think Mike Phelan was mentioned, and then Solskjaer addressed it because he is actually. I think he's either just finished his role up with the Central Coast Mariners, and or he's still contracted to them as their technical director.
Yeah,
but I think Solskjaer said he wants him in his current role and. Central Coast Mariners are one of the clubs that offered Usain Bolt a trial. So
yeah, this is the thing about Man United as well, is they've hired a manager that got relegated with Cardiff and then was at Mold.
Yeah.
And then his assistant that's doing wonders was, as you said, not a greatly successful something
to
at
be
Central
fair,
Coast Mariners.
Phelan has proved himself to be a great number two.
I think so Solskjaer said he likes him in his current job, and that would be where I would go with it. I wouldn't give him the job because I'd want him right there. Because Solskjaer is not just... the Solskjaer appointment is not just about the head coach, it's about the package that comes with him and his willingness to sort of he's very much a servant of the club. Another guy linked is Paul Mitchell, who is Spurs former transfer guru, and I just did air quotes when I said that because it's
after last week telling me that no one could see
because it's a bit of a cringe term, but he's the guy who initially got blamed for the Moussa Sissoko signing at Spurs, which actually seems to be sort of playing out.
He must be laughing now.
Yeah, but at the same time it's like, again, Moussa Sissoko is working out because they have a world-class coach at Tottenham. They don't have a world-class coach at Man United. They've got a very good manager who's a very good coach system, but there's no Pochettino at United. If they buy Sissoko, he's going to stay at Sissoko.
I'm not saying they're going to hire this guy who's going to be, get me Moussa Sissoko.
I meant Sissoko. So the next thing is, say if they do get 200 million, current setup have it. And again, with Ed Woodward, I just want to sort of say on that, Will's completely correct.
Yeah.
In terms of getting them all the money, you don't want anyone else, but just get him away from making all of these football decisions.
He can get the money, he can't spend it.
Exactly.
I mean, look, the thing is...
So, Mo, if you were given the job and you were spending it, who are you getting in?
United had four big needs, right? Very clearly, centre-back, right-back, right-wing, and defensive midfield. Okay, McTominay's coming in, he's a good defensive midfield option. He makes Matic redundant, whatever. But now there's these Pogba leaving to Real Madrid rumours, and honestly, if you're a French playmaker and Zinedine Zidane says, hey, come play for me... And it's Real Madrid as well, and you've got Mina Rada, your agent going, come on, do it, I can make 20 million commission. You know, how do you, it's likely to happen, let's put it that way. So if you're not going to lose him, they have to buy another one. So it's five players they need, that's a lot. Centre back is the obvious, there's one obvious candidate standing above everyone else, we'll talk about more later, is Koulibaly from Napoli. He's by far and away the best candidate. I can't even imagine anyone coming close to being as good as him. Given that Van Dijk is not available, Piqué is not available, and Samuel Umtiti may have dodgy knees. Right back, again, Wan-Bissaka, we saw earlier against Sané, just a phenomenal player, absolutely brilliant, can defend, can attack, is young, is English, you know, he's not Ashley Young, which is very important as well.
But Man United fans always say that they've got Dalot.
Yeah, but you know what? As much as we all like Dalot, is he really that good? Mm. Yeah, he looks to have a lot of a good attitude. He looks to have a lot of... But he's not good now. He'll be good in maybe 3 years. United need someone that'll be good now because they can't play Ashley Young there in big games. Mm. And Dalot, I don't think, is necessarily the answer. He seems to have a lot of gumption about him, but Wan-Bissaka's different class. You know, and it comes to that, what kind of club do you want to be? Do you want to be the kind of club that settles for having a prospect like Dalot, or do you want to actually have some quality players? We've seen what a jump Liverpool have made this season when they signed, okay, let's stop messing about, let's sign some actual players. Van Dijk, Fabinho, Naby Keita, look how good they are now. Defensive midfielder, the obvious target we've also talked about earlier today is Declan Rice. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like I'm just repeating people we talked about on the podcast, but yeah, these are the obvious answers. Declan Rice, young, English, again. You know,
but perfect. These are very, so you've, that's a 21 year old and a 20 year old, and then I imagine Jadon Sancho is apparently their top target. He's 18, no, just turned 19, sorry. So that is a
here we go. This is where I'm coming into. Obviously, you sign Koulibaly, he's 27, he's going to be your defensive leader, right, alongside Lindelof. And then the other midfielder that you sign, because if Pogba is going, which let's be honest, probably he is, looks like he is, and Ander Herrera is about to boogie on out the door as well. Rakitic from Barcelona. They want to sell him because they've got Frankie de Jong and they've got a wage bill that's even bigger than Man United. He's world class. He's not necessarily suited to where Barcelona play football, but the way Man United play football, the way they want to, with direct straight line play on a break especially. They need a solid defensive midfielder who can hold the ball, shield the ball, protect his defence and get the ball forward in time. Rakitic is everything they want. He's 30 years old. He's won everything, been to a World Cup final. Rakitic and Koulibaly are the experienced signings. Jadon Sancho is, I was going to say, is the right winger. Jadon Sancho, Wan-Bissaka and Declan Rice as the young players to keep the youth tradition going.
500 million spent on Man United this summer. Sam, you raised your hand. Do you have something to say?
Yeah, I was
going to
touch on, so we're talking about the sort of commercial side of things, and I think that's where United are sort of trapped in, that because they're such a success commercially, that has a big influence on the players that they are signing, because you, as United, if you say we're signing Ryan Fraser from Bournemouth this summer, then that's not marquee enough. Mm. So they're caught.
He might be able to play an instrument though. They might be able to get him in the centre circle at Old Trafford doing the violin.
It's almost like they're
stereotypically bagpipes would be Ryan Fraser, wouldn't it?
It's like they're caught between two minds to sort of sign these marquee players that they need.
Or actually build a squad.
Exactly. Intelligently. Or actually build a squad and make some sort of pragmatic decisions.
But that's why they need someone to say to Ed Woodward, yes, if we just went and signed X player that's a massive name and we could sell a million shirts, that would be good for that way, but he's going to be on the bench in a year because he's 48. That's what I mean. You need someone to sort of counterbalance the decision. It doesn't look like they have that. They're going against Barcelona. 1-0 is a better result than they had against PSG, and they turned that around. We had many listeners' questions from K. Shrey Jha, many Barcelona focused. So to lead on the like major battle in this Barcelona-Man United section, just quickly, he said, with Busquets having a really average season, which you probably have an opinion on anyway, Mo, is there a chance that De Jong can replace him in the starting 11 as soon as next season? And also, in general, Busquets struggled a bit at Old Trafford, should have been booked, was making quite a few fouls that were sort of indicative of him maybe not grasping it completely. Can they afford for him to have a similar performance at Camp Nou, or is it just going to be a completely different kettle of fish?
I mean, first of all, he's not having a bad season, but he has been had quite a few bad games, because the thing with Busquets is that if there is, even when he's at his peak, one weakness is very obvious: he's not athletic, right? He can't cover, like, you know, you look at him and Kante, it's quite funny because they'd be the most amazing double pivot in the world, because Kante, whereas Kante's like, ooh, space to cover, yes, and he drives on it. Busquets doesn't have that closing speed, doesn't have that athleticism, he can't do that. And what happened at Old Trafford was Rakitic had as bad a game as I can remember him having in a long time, and that Busquets had loads of space to cover, and Busquets as a result was terrible. Should have been lucky to not get sent off, to be honest. I would say he made at least three yellow card worthy challenges, got away with it, didn't play very well. Not likely to happen again. Got rested the weekend, didn't play, will have had a week's rest. Usually he always sags at this point of the season because he has to play every single game because he's so important to the club. The last three quarterfinal eliminations Barcelona have had partly have been because Messi and Busquets in particular have been very tired at this point of the season. Busquets now getting a week of rest, that's going to help him. Barca played as badly as they have probably all season.
Messi had one shot against a rubbish free kick
at Old Trafford. They didn't play well at all, with the exception of Piqué, who was amazing, and maybe Jordi Alba. They didn't play well at all. Man United did very sensibly to play five across the back to shut down Jordi Alba's overlapping attack, and then without Ousmane Dembele or Messi or Suarez producing a moment of magic, it was just nothing there. Plus also Valverde, they played well for 15 minutes, got the goal. I think Valverde is naturally, I've often lamented, he's a naturally cautious manager. I think he just thought, oh, we're winning 1-0 away from home, let's just be happy with that. And it was, as a result, a very turgid game. Second leg, they're going to want to come out and kill it, because any Man United goal suddenly turns the whole thing into a circus. Barca are much better at home anyway. Messi's had a week of rest. Suarez had a week of rest. You know, he rotated hugely against Huesca. Only from that team, I only think Arthur will play and Jordi Alba will play, and Ter Stegen will play against Man United. So it's and Dembele maybe. It's a massively rotated side. I would suspect, you know, Barca will have a completely different kind of energy. They'll be really out to it. Plus, United know they have to score now, so they can't come out in their five-man defence. They have to come out with a four. There's no Luke Shaw. He did a very good job on Leo Messi. He's not going to be there. Messi, well, again, unless Chris Smalling punches him in the face again.
Yeah,
this is the other thing as well. Chris Smalling was very rough and ready with the Barca players at Old Trafford, which the referee let him get away with, in partly because it was at home and whatever. But in the camp now, with everyone whistling every single thing he does wrong, he's not going to be able to be as physical. And if he can't, you know, elephant knocking over, you know, like in Jumanji when the elephants all come rocking to the
stampede.
Room. If he can't stampede Messi like he did before and smack him in the face and get away with it, that's going to limit his effectiveness. I think Barca will have too much for United, but you never know, but you kind of know.
You never know, but Mo knows. And if he does know and does get it right, he's going to remind us that he knew. But something else that we want you to know now is De Jong rightfully going to move in and just usurp every Barcelona midfielder in that?
I mean, he could literally usurp any Barcelona midfielder. That's how good he is. I think he'll more likely slot into Rakitic's position rather than Busquets's. But if they sign another midfielder, or if we convert Coutinho to midfielder, or if Barcelona's checkered kit convinces Rakitic to take a pay cut and stay, then, you know, yeah, Frankie could replace Busquets. He could replace anyone. He's phenomenal. I mean, did you watch him against Juventus? He was incredible.
Well, exactly. And we'll discuss a bit more about the Juve game when we do the actual predictions later. But we're going to take a little break now, and then we'll discuss a bit of Premier League and the Europa League clubs. So now moving on to Europe's more luxury competition, arguably, and the teams that are in it are obviously better. We're going to look quickly at Arsenal. We mentioned Chelsea and they're probably going to go through against Slavia Prague, especially at Stamford Bridge. But Arsenal, who keep playing on a Monday, so we can't actually talk about them, despite getting quite a few questions
Monday
on
merchants.
Arsenal themselves. Monday and Thursdays, that's all Arsenal are going to live for. But they've got a chance of playing again Tuesday, Wednesday. Anyway, 2-0 win against Napoli in the first leg, which was quite a volatile game. If anything, we were saying just a bit before off air that it could have been like 5-2 to Arsenal.
It was the most fun 2-0 I've seen in a long time.
Exactly, and Aaron Ramsey was the main star of that Arsenal show. Playing again, it seems bizarre that he was never played in this deeper role alongside either Xhaka or Torreira earlier on in the season, because he's been brilliant since moving there alongside both Xhaka and Torreira. He obviously made the difference and scored against Napoli, which he might be doing a lot more of in the future. First question is that 2-0 going to be enough for a Napoli team that, like Arsenal, are very good at home?
I mean, look, it all depends on what kind of mood Milik is in, right? Because if he didn't start the game, he came off the bench and had a couple of chances or created some disruption. If he starts the game in sort of form, if Napoli score early or get a good chance early, and I mean, the San Paolo can get loud. So, and Arsenal are famously terrible away from home. So it probably is, because 2-0 usually is a very solid race. And I would bet, frankly, on Arsenal to be able to nick one on the break. Just because with the pace they've got and with Ramsey's movement and it's hard to pick him up, man. He times his runs so well. He just sort of drifts into space. It's very hard to sort of keep track of him as a defensive player. You know, because he moves in from a zone where Koulibaly isn't. So it's harder for Koulibaly to protect everything. So I think Arsenal lose, but I think they'll probably get a goal, which we'll see them through.
So like a 2-1.
Yeah, something.
Because
like
it was funny with Koulibaly, in the first 10 minutes of the Arsenal game, I was convinced that it was going to be one of those performances where nothing absolutely got past him. He'd already made like a block, tackle, one a header, two clearances in the first 10 minutes. And then luckily, he got sort of pulled out of position for one goal, and then Torreira's goal, that was his, ended up being an own goal for Koulibaly. So as you said earlier in the podcast about him, he's clearly still a very good defender.
Oh, he's unreal.
And Man United would probably be advised to invest heavily in someone like that. You mentioned that other people, there weren't many other defenders. Milan Skriniar, who plays for Inter Milan, is younger and also is one defender that I'd say other clubs should be looking at. But that was just me trying to get a point about him being good. Koulibaly, again, could be leaving Napoli. They regretted missing some chances there, but obviously Aaron Ramsey, as I said, was key to that Arsenal win, and he's going. Is how did that, you've mentioned about Man United making spending about 600 million in the summer. If Arsenal had like an unlimited budget, is there anyone that you can even see off the top of your head that would replace Aaron Ramsey, or have Arsenal absolutely shot themselves in the foot because he does so many different things?
I think they really have shot themselves in the foot, because off the top of my head, I can't think of anyone that they could actually get, let's be honest.
Exactly.
Because I mean, you know, you could say someone like Thiago Alcantara has this sort of all-encompassing skill set where he could
Saul.
Do that. Saul isn't a gun, but you know, Saul would cost like north of 100 million. Easily.
Being linked to both Manchester clubs as well.
For north of 100 million. Arsenal are, let's spend 100 million on a midfielder kind of club.
Emery did say they should be making their Van Dijk signing.
I mean, look, if they have 100 million to spend on a player and they need someone that can do everything midfield, then Saul is the guy, right? So there's definitely players out there, but it's just a matter of how much money Arsenal have to spend. I think Ramsey is phenomenal. It's got to be so galling to lose a player that good for free. I mean, it's a catastrophic example, a moment of mismanagement, because he's so perfect for Unai Emery's football as well. That's the thing. It's not just that he's a good player. He's always been a good player. He's so well suited to what Emery wants to do.
And he's not been using him though. That's what's even more bizarre.
It's almost like, you know how PSG are struggling with it, and they've been told not to play Adrien Rabiot because he's leaving on a free. It's almost like someone told Emery you can't play him, and now it's like, oh, go on then, you can play him if you want. And he's just like, thankfully,
if he's going to win us the Europa League, you can play him. Just a quick word on PSG: have had 2 weeks to try and wrap up the title, drew to Strasbourg, and then just got pumped 5-1 by Lille. Which was incredible. Jose Font scoring.
Yeah,
which is,
I didn't even realise he was at Lille.
Yeah, Lille are doing,
still in China.
Again, Lille, you could do a segment on Lille, etc., being really exciting, because Nicolas Pepe was a player that was linked a lot with Arsenal in January as solving their winger crisis, coming in, being this wide forward to replace Welbeck, who looks likely that he'll move on because of injuries and contract. But someone that's popped up in recent weeks is Ryan Fraser as the winger. Which again, as you mentioned him for Man United, and says not being the most exciting signing by name, but when you look at his numbers this season, that are inflated by the fact that he takes set pieces, of course. He's got 11 assists. He got two initially in the 5-0 win against Brighton. One was taken away because I think there was a slight deviation, but his pass was rewarded. And Will, just a thought on, is this Ryan Fraser link something to be excited about first, and is it substantial enough to actually bother talking about, despite the fact that we are?
I can't think of many other potential Arsenal signings that make more sense than this one.
Ooh.
I could see it happening, just to be clear. He might not fit the description of, like, as you alluded to, the Van Dijk transformative signing.
He's literally half the size of Van Dijk.
In so many ways does he not fit the Van Dijk profile. So Emery there is talking about a signing that's going to come in and instantly improve the first 11. I don't know if necessarily Ryan Fraser is that guy, but I don't see how a club can go from January chasing loan deals with a permanent option to buy and being very public with the fact that they don't have a great amount of money to spend or invest, goes from that to setting a transfer record in the summer. I don't think that's really in the cards. This means that they're therefore going to have to be a bit clever with how they make this transformative signing. And Ryan Fraser is a player who, earlier on in the season, maybe less so now, could credibly have claimed to be among the best of the rest in terms of, like, the best player outside the big six in terms of form. He's a player whose contract expires in 2020, so they're probably imagining that it's basically obvious that they're imagining that they can drive the price down for that reason. 25, so you're going to get his peak years. And I think, as you said there, is it 11 or 12 assists?
So it's now officially 11 assists, right, which is still only one behind Eriksen and Hazard in the Premier League ranking.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's huge. A player who gets over 10 double figures for assists. Like Mesut Ozil has only ever done that once, and he's the assist king. Yeah. Which is not to denigrate Mesut Ozil at all. It's just
there's a couple of nines and eights in there.
This is output that deviates substantially from what Ryan Fraser put out previously. But I do remember there was a stat, I don't know if it was like last season or the one before, where he'd like won more penalties than any other player in Europe's top five leagues. And he's a player who, I remember we were looking at, like, we were on the sort of stats tool that we use and going through his stuff. And he's a player who just barely ever commits any fouls. but he seems to get fouled all the time.
It's because he's got absolutely no weight to put behind any challenge, so anything he does is just a little
still
nibble.
A little nibble at someone's ankle as they're running away. He's not going to be the Van Dijk. He's not going to be a Van Dijk impact level of signing, but he's realistic and genuinely exciting.
He played in the SPL just like Van Dijk. Don't rule it out, man. Yeah.
Aberdeen as well, your old stamping ground.
Well, stomping ground. Oh, it was a ground I went to.
Now we've left every Squawker Talker listener piecing together what Mo did in Aberdeen and when he was there. So don't tell. Don't tell anything. People can use their imagination there. My take on this Ryan Fraser situation is that, yes, because he's running down his contract, fits the profile of a winger that is needed. It is very nippy, as we've said. Takes a good corner, which Arsenal have rotated all of their set-piece takers this season anyway, quite bizarrely. So would add a lot to the squad, definitely. And if he's there for 20 million, then, yeah, you'd say that's a shrewd signing in the current market. But David Brooks, in that Bournemouth side, who, yes, is not putting up the same numbers, but in terms of sort of a higher ceiling, better quality, I think that would be transferable to a side that is deemed to be better, because Bournemouth are really bizarre this season in the sense that they started really well, then they've been really bad, and then they go and smash Brighton 5-0, which not many people do at the Amex anyway. But David Brooks, who obviously is a Welsh international, playing in that really exciting Wales team, was actually a part of England's Toulon tournament winning side alongside people like Harvey Barnes, who's been impressive at Leicester. Reece James was playing right wing back in that tournament, who's been great. So David Brooks has got these credentials of being a really exciting young player. And I just think if anyone's looking to cherry pick any players from Bournemouth, obviously Callum Wilson is going to be up there. He's having another great season and was heavily involved against Brighton. You've got Ryan Fraser, as we've mentioned, that is leading assist charts for them, but I think David Brooks would be the one player in that attacking lot, because obviously Nathan Ake himself is a very interesting prospect. But if I was going to pick one attacker from Bournemouth's team that I'd want Arsenal to sign, or any club I think should sign, the brilliance of David Brooks on the ball and his intelligence for someone so young just ticks every single box I think you could ever imagine, because he can play wide, he can play as a number 10. I just think that is the ultimate package. And does Eddie Howe deserve credit for giving these players a platform to be that impressive, because they were quite gushing reviews of their players that we just heard?
I mean, he definitely deserves credit, but I feel with Bournemouth he might have almost taken them as far as they can go. So they're 12th now. Previous finishes of 16th, 9th and 12th. But they're on course to set a record points total this season. They're currently on 41. So they've established themselves, but they don't ever look like they're truly going to pull clear of the relegation battle. So it's a difficult one for Howe. He used to, you know, a couple of seasons ago, well, he was always linked with the Arsenal job, wasn't he? And I still feel that another job as big as that is beyond him. So then he's maybe looking at a sideways step. It's a really difficult position for him to be in.
And it's so weird with that massive cluster of Premier League teams, the sideways one could go so wrong. And then obviously people like Everton have looked like they have to put their eggs in the Marco Silva basket at the moment. There's progression there. But then they lose 2-0 to Fulham. There's so many weird clubs in that Premier League mid-table.
I feel it's the same with the players as well. Because if you were playing for a team like Bournemouth, then you'd say that they'd be at risk of losing their players to a West Ham, an Everton. Whereas
actually that much better.
Exactly, yeah. But if the shoe was on the other foot, then you'd probably say that Bournemouth wouldn't be able to buy West Ham's best players or Everton's best players. So it's Bournemouth are in that pack, but it still feels like they're at the bottom of that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And Ryan Fraser, I think himself, had said, oh, it was very nice to be linked with Arsenal. Eddie Howe addressed it as like, yeah, it's going to be a bit difficult, as Will said, the contract running down. But necessarily picking the best players from other teams in the division is not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, so Bayern Munich.
I was going to say, Juventus and Bayern Munich do it to a brilliant level in their own league. So Arsenal might, again, Will said about it making sense. Maybe just saying, right, this guy's had a really, really, really good season in the Premier League. Why don't we just pick him up and plonk him on our team?
Everton have kind of done that though, and it hasn't worked out well for them. Yeah. When they've got Sigurdsson,
Richarlison. Well, both their top scorers this season.
That is partly because they just forgot to get a striker.
Yeah.
Like if they had thought,
they might have signed Richarlison.
Richarlison. They wanted as well, wasn't it? But Richarlison, I think, is potentially a striker, but right now.
Yeah. I think the problem with Everton is what they do is they've formed a Frankenstein monster of a team, and they've cherry picked the rest of the rest as from their position of being like just sort of like seventh or whatever, yeah, best team, and they've also taken the scraps of the tables of the teams above them, so they're getting like players like Theo Walcott,
yeah. And that's so you get really unbalanced.
But then, yeah, so like Fraser compared to a Theo Walcott, like it's worth taking the punt on Fraser if his contract's running down, his wages aren't going to be that big.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be really funny actually to put Fraser in the Everton team, commit to Richarlison as a number nine, basically make him take shooting training, make him work at it. Yeah, he could do it. And of course, Everton do also have the best centre back in the world, Yerry Mina. So, you know.
Don't get in the team. Michael Keane and Zuma, just probably their first choice. But Zuma could be going, so we might finally see something of Yerry Mina. But moving on from that Arsenal analysis, and a bit of extra Premier League bonus content there, which means that we're going to have another little pause, but then it means the predictions at the end of this one again. With so much football going on, we're going to fire through those so that you can let us know, and we can let you know if we were right. So for the final part of the podcast, we'll be, as I said, looking at the predictions of all the European games this week. We're going to start with the game that we haven't really touched on yet, which is Juventus-Ajax, which for the first leg was such a good watch. Frenkie de Jong, again, as Mo said earlier, was magnificent. Dusan Tadic, whose goal involvement this season has now gone up to 50 goals, which is quite nuts. And Southampton players are absolutely doing bits all over the world this season. Cristiano Ronaldo scored, came back. Juventus again missed another chance to win Serie A at the weekend, despite playing a completely rotated team. But this is obviously what they massively want. Ajax, obviously, in the first leg against Real Madrid, lost at home and then turned up to the Bernabeu and destroyed it. They've got a 1-1 this time, going to Juventus Stadium, which, as you said on the podcast last week, Mo, Juventus aren't actually as solid as they used to be. And Allegri said that Chiellini might not be risked in the hope that they'd beat Ajax and then they'd use him for the semi-finals. So, again, as I said, these don't have to be one-word predictions, because just thoughts on this game as a game in itself first. And then also, once you've done a little bit of analysis, what do you think is going to be the outcome of this one?
I think Chiellini not playing is huge, because I think Bonucci didn't come back from Milan the same player. He looks like something's gone in him, which is weird. And I think they need Chiellini's organisation, especially now without Buffon. Ajax were phenomenal, arguably the better team in the first leg. I mean, they were unlucky. You know, they forgot to mark the Champions League all-time record goal scorer in the penalty area.
He's almost unmarkable, though, isn't he? I think that's his thing.
Yeah, and it was just like, you know, they got punished, duly punished. And I think, I think they'll play brilliantly again. I think part of the reason why they managed to beat Real Madrid at the Bernabeu was because the Real Madrid were at the time overcome with this great anxiety. You know, as a club, they were like, oh my God, what are we doing? Having an existential crisis. I don't think Juve necessarily having that, but their failure to clinch Serie A the weekend means they do still have something in the back of their minds about, we have to go out and win Serie A. And
they definitely don't have to have that in their minds.
They literally just go out and do it. Like, they haven't done it yet. They will do it, but they haven't done it yet. And also, I do think the fact that they're already almost overlooking Ajax by saying we might rest Chiellini,
that's what Real Madrid did with Ramos.
Yeah, there's just an element
he got sent off.
He did it. I don't think the club would, but there's an element of just if it's just an element of they're overlooking Ajax. Now again, they've got a more informed team than Real Madrid did, right? Or whatever. They've got the goal scorer to make up for it. So it's going to be harder for them. I think Juve will have too much, just purely on a goal scoring form. I think they'll win 2-1. I think Ajax will dominate the game. I think they will probably even take the lead. I just think at some point it's hard. De Ligt is very, very, very good, but he's one guy, and they've not got Tagliafico. He's going to miss the game to suspension. Yes. And I think Juve will have raid Cancelo down the right, sending crosses, and I think Cristiano and Mandzukic and that, they're too good in the air.
Yeah.
I think they'll just be caught out like that. But I do think they'll play brilliantly. And it's going to be sad to watch this like get picked apart in the summer.
Yeah, exactly. And sad, but also exciting, because it's like you want them to then prove it on another level.
Definitely.
And in the first leg, Daley Blind was the only outfield player that didn't have a shot against Juventus. That's obviously not a good thing. Ziyech had 7, 2 on target. But again, he's they're so brilliant to watch. Like genuinely, as I said last week on the podcast, this Juventus Ajax game is just such a good watch because you've got Juventus with the pressure of signing Ronaldo to win the Champions League. Yeah. And then you've got these team that have come out of nowhere, assembled a great young squad that, as you said, is probably the last time they're ever going to be all together, looking to make history, really. So, Will, thoughts on Juventus Ajax? Who's going through? Maybe what's the score?
Yeah, I mean, last week I went for 2-1 or something, like Juventus would win but not play. Yeah. It'd be like an undeserved win. And that's the vibe I'm getting off this one.
Yeah.
pretty much like, yeah, what Mo said. Like, for all the reasons he gave, like getting cut down the break, those crosses. Like, Ronaldo, I don't know if this is necessarily a sort of an isolated thing, but this season his runs to just like get the jump on defenders right at the back and scoring these like bullet headers just seems to be what he does this season. And that's a case of like complacency and lack of concentration. He just feeds on that, and if you could expect any team to fall foul of that level of lapses in concentration, then it would be like the young and inexperienced
Ajax. The gung-ho team where the fullback's charging forward, Ronaldo's like, oh, that's a nice little space around the back, and obviously most headed goals in the competition's history. And I as Mo and Will have said now, I expect him to almost add another of those. So
if you want a scoreline,
let's have that.
I'll give you a scoreline.
Yep.
2-0 Juventus.
Ooh. Okay.
A cleanie as well. Mm. Sam, any thoughts on that game?
I'm going 2-0 as well.
Oh, really? So Ajax no goals. I'd be sort of, if I was saying Ajax win, that would be very much heart, and head says Juventus.
De Jong's also a bit of a fitness down.
Yeah, he'll definitely play. He'll definitely be in there. If it's 2-2, Ajax go through away goals, don't they?
Yes, they go through. Come on, do it, Jake.
No, because I always default to 2-2. Oh, I'm going to say 1-1 then, and then penalties, and then Ajax might crumble penalty-wise. But it'll be an exciting game. Definitely watch it.
That'd be a good shootout, that would.
Ronaldo would take the fifth one, wouldn't he? Shirt off.
100%, yeah.
Shirt off. Juventus through to the semi-final. And who do Juventus get in the semi-final?
Man City or Spurs.
Is it Man City? Oh, so we'll move on to that next. But the other Tuesday game is Barcelona United. Again, we talked about that loads earlier on. Barcelona, Busquets not having the same problems probably as before. Messi and Suarez likely to reverse their away form. Although Messi's still hunting for that quarterfinal goal.
It's
been 12 games now. So quick fire on this one. Will Messi get that? Will it be a Barcelona
win? I think Messi will get that because now he's got a point to prove. He didn't play very well in the away legs, blah, 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 blah. And I just think... he'll look to shut the critics up, and McTominay will play well, but not well enough. Barca win probably 3-1, maybe more if Dembele plays, but I don't think he will. So 3-1, I'd say.
3-1 Barcelona. Will,
I think 1-1. 1-1. I think it'll be. This is just. I'm just guessing.
I think that's what predictions are. I think you're okay to guess.
Is this how that works?
Yeah.
But 1-1. But I think it'll be a result that it could be like 1-0 Barcelona again. But basically, the gist of what I'm predicting is that it will be a defeat that allows Solskjaer and Man United to save face so they can bow out gracefully.
Sam, are they going to be saving any baby faces?
I think 3-1 to Barca with an unconcussed Messi.
Yeah, unconcussed. And actually being able to see out of both eyes. I think it was just going to be like a really sort of comfortable 2-0. I don't think Man United, the counter-attacking they had against PSG, Barcelona, as you said, with Valverde being a bit more aware of it.
Yeah.
And based on what I saw in the first leg, remember, United didn't have a shot on target.
Valverde doesn't take the kind of risks that United would need him to take to capitalise on.
Exactly.
Basically.
Mo has worded my thoughts exactly there. So I think 2-0 Barcelona there. Finally, moving on to Wednesday, Porto versus Liverpool. Quick round trip on this one.
0-0. I think they're just going to go see it out and get on with things.
Will?
I think it's going to be like a relative scare. Maybe Porto score first, but then Liverpool 2-1.
Yeah. So
2-0 Liverpool. Straightforward.
Yeah, I think I agree with Will's guessing there. I think 2-1. I think Porto deserve a goal. They haven't scored against Liverpool yet in the Champions League in the last two seasons, so they deserve one. And then the big one, really, all English tie, Man City Spurs. We'll go reverse way around this way, Sam. I'll throw it on you straight away.
I think... Was he ready?
I'm testing.
I think Man City will win 2-1 on the night. So Spurs to go through on away goals with Eriksen to score.
Oh, he's being specific.
Mm.
Where were you as specific?
No, 2-0, Man City.
2-0.
I just think they'd probably be playing, they'll probably play better.
I think Spurs are going to get splattered all over the Etihad, but I do think Hugo Boss and Yann Vertonghen will have good games, so I think it will.
Did you say Hugo Boss?
Hugo Boss, mate. I do think it'll only be 2-0 to Man City, but I do think Raheem Sterling is going to score at least one of them, probably the other one, maybe Leroy Sané, maybe finally Aguero. But yeah, I think
that's
City.
That's 3-0, that isn't it? Yeah. That's 3-0.
Yeah, but they're two amazing.
I'm joking. Man City, what did I think about that? Because the bad thing about listening to all you first is it makes me doubt my own. I think I'm just going to double down on 3-1 last week and just repeat that.
I will say, if I had heard everyone else's Barcelona Man United predictions before doing mine, I definitely would have just played it safe and gone with the group.
I'm going to say 3-1 Man City. So that means Man City go through just. But it will be an exciting game, I think. And then, just a little Thursday one. Don't really have to give scores for this because who knows what's going to happen in the Europa League. Will Arsenal go through against Napoli, mate?
Yeah, 3-1 on Napoli, so they'll go through on away goals.
Ooh. Will?
I've done a scoreline prediction for you.
Yeah, you can give it if you want. I just didn't want to put any added pressure on anyone.
1-1. 1-1.
Arsenal through. Easy.
2-1 Arsenal.
2-1 Arsenal.
I think Chelsea will go through as well.
I'm pretty sure.
I was going to say...
I think Valencia kind of tied up against Villarreal, so I think they'll end up facing Arsenal, I think, in the semi-final if Arsenal get there.
I can't remember, yeah.
And then Chelsea get either Frankfurt or
that game is over because despite João Félix being the youngest ever player to score a hat-trick, and we're talking about players that are going to be linked to Man United in the summer,
he's going to be linked to everyone.
He's going to be linked to everyone.
Hat-trick and an assist, and he caused a penalty as well, won the penalty.
And even at the weekend, he repeated the performance and done well. So Benfica-Frankfurt, if I'm saying Juventus-Ajax is the exciting Champions League one, Benfica-Frankfurt's probably the key one you need to watch in the Europa League, because do not rule out Frankfurt in that game.
Not with Jovic.
Two away goals.
Yeah.
If they win 2-0...
Yeah. That's going to be
they're
really
sorted,
good.
So that'll be a class game. And again, yeah, so many young talents to look out for in the Europa League. But that is all we've got time for this week. And we probably didn't have time for any of that last bit, but we've got to deliver the predictions because we know you love them. So all that leads me to do is to say thank you to Mo, Will and Sam. I'll do it all at once and you don't get to speak to wrap it up. So thank you for joining us. And please, as I say every week, please rate and review and subscribe to the Squawker Talker because we want to keep going and we want more people to hear it. We'll speak to you next Monday.